This is Edris Wise speaking to Joseph Poyce on January the 4th, 1985, for National Council of Jewish Women Oral History Project 2.
She was a very nice one. I was associate of the area. I remember that they showed they had gone there a lot during World War II, so the old shul, they still haven't fixed it as yet. But we went to a part of it, but again, there were not enough people there for a service. But yet, the Jewish fellow wanted to know what, he saw we were looking for a shul, so he asked us what. He took us to the shul. He waited and then actually escorted us back to our hotel. And I got a great kick out of it. And he did too. Mm-hmm. First of all, he was glad to see a fellow Jew. And so,
what about the Jews in India? Talk a little bit about
that. Well, in Delhi, see, I didn't get to see them in Bombay, where there is a large Jewish community. Delhi, it's a dying group. There are only a few left, because again, they feel the undercurrent.
All right, you're speaking in present tense. You mean when you were there, or
that,
this recent?
Well, no,
event,
no.
When you were there,
when I was there. Okay. So that they felt that that India was not the place for them. So the younger people were migrating from India. There were just a few left. They would have services every Friday. They could not have them on Saturday. If there was a bar mitzvah, in order to get a minyan, then they would call around to some of the embassies, if there were Jewish staff members, and ask them to come to the service. Friday night they had it, because it's more of a Sephardic tradition. And although my father was born in Turkey, I still sort of follow the Ashkenazi tradition. But they would conduct the service, and it was
which language would they use for the service?
They were sort of the Aramaic language, and they were very nice. There was a kiddush, and they were very anxious for us to be present. And it was interesting. For example, the women wore safaris. Oh, is that what they call them?
Sorry,
I'm sorry. Yeah, got them with safaris. That would be embarrassing. Approach woman about a safari. Yeah, that's right. But it might be misunderstood. But anyhow, they wore the saris, and of course these were Jews who had been in the tree. The families had been there for years, and I remember my wife commenting on one who was so beautiful. She said she almost had, if you could put it, seems strange to say about a Jewish Madonna-like expression. She sat there with such dignity during the service, and then we were invited to home for dinner. You see, in our case, we weren't tourists. You see, we were, and of course, although they were trying to observe the religion, they couldn't. First of all, they couldn't observe the kashrut, as they say, the dairy food, the melodics and fleshdicks were mixed. And then we were trying to find out what we ate. Whether it was goat meat or some goddamn thing, but anyhow, they did their best. They did their best to observe the ritual as much as they could. And they had a little shul there. They had a cemetery outside the shul. I still got a little note because when we gave them the contribution, they gave us a very formal acknowledgement of the contribution we had made. And the extension of the book. And one of the groups, Jewish groups in Israel, which they gave us as a going away gift. All I can say is that the warmth which they extended to us was absolutely over. You came away with such a feeling of gratification and almost love for them. That's the way I felt about the Jews, and just a few and young people. Met a few, because they gave us a little going away party. There were just a few younger people, but they know that to be with the attitude of the Indians, that India is not for them. Now Bombay, and I didn't have a chance Well, I did lecture in Bombay, but I didn't have a chance to meet the people in the Jewish community there. It has a much larger population. You see, India has very limited relations with Israel. They do have a council down in Bombay, but an Israeli council. But there's very, very little else in terms of the Jews. In Delhi, they're out, I imagine. Ultimately, there really will be no Jews in Delhi. And the Indian government is nourishing much in the way of friendship towards Israel. In fact, when we were there, the PLO opened an office not too far from the shul, and the shul sent us a notice to that effect and pointed out that one should be very careful with the activity of the PLO, but saying that the police department had been notified and that they were going to give additional protection to the shul. And so that you had the feeling that the Jew was not in a very secure position.
Right, this is just an aside, but I was just thinking, in all your travels, do you speak other languages other than English?
Well, I feel at home, of course. I had almost a major in German, but I found that that's sort of a limited value when I tried it out. And recently, you know, I was in Yugoslavia, and they hate the Germans. So, you know, I remember on my first trip to when my wife and I visited Yugoslavia back then, when I was just trying to reconstruct with our notes when it was 67. So I was told you better not speak German because the Germans are hated, even though they understand the German. Switzerland, it helps.
Did you find you spoke English then most of the time?
Most of the time English. But let me point out, many countries you are at disadvantage. That India, although the educated people, the cultured people do still speak English, but many, many Indians do not speak English. And even getting around Delhi in a taxi got to be a problem. And when we, for example, left the guest house, the Ford guest house, you see, we stayed when we, as a consultant, we lived at the Ford guest house. But what happened, they would call a taxi for us, and they would give instructions onto the taxi cab driver. It was usually a Sikh, by the way. The Sikhs. In a sense, in some respect, like the Jews of India, they're the entrepreneurs. I mean, they're the businessmen. They run these taxis. They run the more successful businesses. But they would always give instructions, and then the individual then would know, because, or else they would give us a little, except if you had to assume that the person would be literate, then they'd give us a little slip of paper to give the tax bill. There's many, many, except of course the merchants who were selling internationally to American tourists and British tourists. Naturally, they speak English, but the people who work for the government speak English. But you might say, if you're talking about the people generally in many of these countries, don't go on the supposition that they know English.
Did you have any contact with Indira Gandhi?
No, I had contact with some of her officials, and I still remember that. The Israel state, but they're not the Israel, the Indian controller. He was a tough one. I remember very, very disagreeable, very, very disagreeable situation, because it's a tough, they can be extremely tough, and I had been making the study of the United States Controller General, on whom I wrote this book, and the book was finished after I came back from India. And he has almost like, he's almost like a fourth branch of the government. What do they call him? The controller in order, the general. I think they use the same term, the British there. And I was making a study. His office is a huge office, has tremendous power within the government. And I was brought in, somebody introduced me to his key subordinates, and they had me go through. And I received a call that the controller and auditor general would like to see both Dr. Tavaraj and myself. And Tavaraj was this man from the Indian Institute of Public Administration. And we went to see the controller and auditor general. And he said, "I understand, Professor Poise, that you've been making a study of my office." I said, "Well, I was told I consulted with your top assistants." And he had his top he brought in his assistants then. And he said, I don't like anything to go out of this office except with my specific approval. I would want anything that you ascertain to be brought to my attention. And he just went around to each of these key assistants of hers and in a sense crucified them in front of me. Just laid. I felt horrible to see people, if you will, demeaned in front of you. It was horrible. And then he got after Tavaraj. Fool, I didn't have too much sympathy, but anyhow, because Tavaraj was an arrogant self, if you will, an arrogant individual. And he said, Dr. Tavaraj, I hope you realize that a large portion of the income of the Institute of Public Administration comes from the Indian government. And that you'll act accordingly. And by the way, that the relationship with Tavaraj, my son, became even worse because Tavaraj had been he had been pushing it out in front of him before he had been by the
humiliation.
And the humiliation. Mm-hmm. And so, and I did meet many of the officials at the seminars, many important officials. See, the Indian Institute of Public Administration conducts seminars. I threw out some of the programs, and I participated in some of the seminars. They bring officials from the state government, and they call their national government from the central government. And so I got to meet many of the important officials and discuss problems with them. And I got a very good insight into them. By the way, the talent in India is amazing. First of all, when you lecture at some of these schools, like the schools of management, one of which is sponsored by Harvard Business School, and the other was sponsored at MIT. And when you were talking to those students, and you figure the competition to get into those schools, you're talking, and don't forget, we get in with a population of 600, 800 million, whatever the dot need is right now, and or was at that time. And you think of the brains, the questions they ask.
Do you think that they take any of what they learn at these seminars and at the schools, because a lot of them do come to the United States for graduate work, that they actually use this in their government?
Well, I tell you,
it doesn't seem to work too well.
Well, you have this problem. I mentioned, I raised a question like that to some of the engineers. Not that I'm an engineer, but there was a seminar, and I was supposed to lecture, I forget what about the fiscal aspects of it. And I spoke to one of the engineers. I said, look now, wherever we are, I forget the name of the road where the Indian Public Administration, I said, I look outside, and I see they're now repairing the highway or the roadway in front of the Indian Public Administration. And I see women then bending down. They have a basket. They put the earth in the basket. They put the basket on top of their head. They walk a little further and then dump it into a truck. And I said, look, here I am sitting in a seminar, and you're talking about some of the most advanced technology, because you people are dealing with the construction of hydroelectric projects, and you're familiar with the most modern equipment. How do we reconcile this? These women are out there. And I said, oh, these work. Just again, very drudgery. And I said, he said, well, Dr. Boyce, what would be the alternative? Suppose we brought in some modern goat construction equipment. What will happen to those women? What do you want us to do?
Did they not practice birth control in India?
That lady was trying. See, that was in your Gandhi. That's where she got in trouble the first time. She actually was trying to force him.
Talk a little bit about Indira Gandhi and
What
was she in government at the time you were there?
Yes, let's see. In that period, I think whether she was in. Let's see. That was what
72 and 73.
I'm trying to recall whether she. Certainly, I felt the impact of it. Let me put it this way. That they were trying to put tremendous pressure upon people.
Was she in part of Parliament then?
Oh, I'm trying to recall what she was in the Parliament. I was trying to recall. I'll have to look it up. Let me look it up. Because but because at that time then they pulled back a little. They tried to do it on something on a voluntary basis in terms, particularly so far as men were concerned, trying to sterilize them. And I remember passing many places where they had these big heads, and they would pay them so much if they were subjecting themselves to it. And this, you see, is so contrary. You see, the problem is, it's so contrary to their tradition. The idea of having children is such an integral part of their tradition that you immediately encounter
God wills.
Yeah, God wills. And of course, all of us, later on, somebody told me, see, the tradition had been, all right, you have many. First of all, at that time, or for a long time, the death rate was so high, to protect yourself, you have a lot of children, hoping then that there are enough so to survive that will then support you in your old age. And to indicate the problem, one of my associates, who since died, I don't know whether you indicate, a fellow named Alvin Roseman, I don't know whether he was in your book or not, he was associate dean of the school for a while, and he had been with UNESCO, he had been the associate director general of UNESCO, which perhaps you've been reading about, when the United States was just withdrawn from UNESCO, Alvin Roseman, and he spent a lot of time in the United States Foreign Service. He went with AID to head up their population planning project, but this business of trying to contraceptive devices and whatnot. You are still fighting a horror, a tradition. You have a tremendous resistance, and the strange thing is these people in abject poverty, these people living in such terrible situations, but you see, they call it the sexual urge, but also coupled with tradition. This is what they do. I remember there was one thing that my wife said she could never forget. We were driving by the railroad station in Calcutta, and there was a little, it's called an infant, 5 months, 6 months, crawling on the sidewalk and trying to reach its mother. And the idea, this was the life of this youngster. See, they don't relate to it. Say, my God, why should we bring something like this into the world to subject that to the thinking of maybe the next world would be something different. And it asked me the impression it made. And you do say, you know, you say about religion, you say, couldn't it? Even though I still go to shul and all of that, but, you know, it leaves you with some basic question. If there's any divine system, how do we reconcile it? I think that. Yeah, I mean,
what about the Mela in India?
The what?
The Mela, which was the, I understand, was the name for the Jewish ghetto.
Well, I didn't see it in Delhi. Maybe it could have been. They did have this. Where is it? Down in the southern part of India, this little Jewish community which was settled many, many years ago, which has since died out. And I think maybe that part of it was called Jewtown, but not in any, as I understand it, any derisive way. So I never did see much in the way of the first one.
Did the smell bother you?
In India?
Yeah, that's what I've heard. The stench was just unbelievable.
Well, of course, it depends upon what area you're in.
That's what made me think of it, was that I know that there have been people from Pittsburgh who have gone on ORT tours,
yeah,
and have gone to look at the schools, one of them being in India.
Yeah, right.
They were taken on a tour of what was called the Mela, which I assumed was the Jewish ghetto.
Which may be
they would take perfumed handkerchiefs.
Which may be in Bombay, which has this, as I said, I didn't get to see the Mela. Well, there is this odor, the hygienic habits are somewhat different. For example, you know, it may be shocking to you if a man wants to urinate, he doesn't hesitate to do it on the street. And
were you affected by the living quality of life there as far as where you were living?
Oh, you see, well, we lived in the Ford guest house was a beautiful structure. See, Ford had a large office building, a beautiful office building. And I once saw somebody recently, I met, by the way, one AID executive. He'd just come back from India, been there, stationed there for several years. I met him at this professor, Mark Perlman's home. I asked him what happened to the Ford, to the office building. So there was a beautiful office building, and there was a beautiful guest house. And really, you live like Lord. I was so spoiled, I tell you, if I'd been there a couple of years, I couldn't
have gotten really used to that.
Because what you had then, you had, you know, my suits would be, I guess, pressed and cleaned most every day. Laundry service, food. Of course, the food, I'm finicky about food anyhow, so I don't want to be fair about it. Their food in India. First, if you eat the real Indian food, but it's highly seasoned, I can't tolerate it. And the food generally is quite poor. But we live in luxury, and that made me very uncomfortable. It's right next to us. They have it called Lodi Park. That's very nice. You can even afford, you can walk through it. When you talk about fragrant, truly, I mean, there's no undesirable odor. But in Lodi Park, they have the people who work in the park. And they lived in the most rudimentary thing. The running water was a pipe, which in the morning it goes to the pipe and get the running water. And you stay there, and here you are. And then right across from us was what do they call it, Indian Institute of Cultural Relations for Indians. But I occasionally go there to listen to a lecture. And we would watch these women doing the same thing. They were doing some maintenance work. And we'd watch the woman, again, with a God-darn basket, lifting up this earth, put it on the head, and then a little youngster would be following her. He'd be holding her skirt or not, and she obviously was pregnant. And then you see the wealthy Indians. I remember once they had a reception, a wedding reception, and they had the wealthy Indians come. Wealthy women. They love to carry these diamonds and then, you know, put them in the nostrils and went right here. And you see these women, and you say, what do they think? They pass this woman who's doing this hardly menial work, and she has a kid holding her by the skirt, and she's pregnant. And here this very haughty Indian woman comes, obviously living in the, if you will, in the lap of luxury. You say, how do you reconcile? Well, somebody said, well, look, if you've been in it long enough, you get accustomed. And I remember I had that experience in Calcutta. I was supposed to continue some lectures, but there I am, sat there, and I just, again, I had a gastrointestinal upset, and I just couldn't lecture. So we just went down, I called, and it was a Calcutta Institute of Management, I just couldn't make it that day. And we went into the courtyard of this hotel, the Grand Hotel in Calcutta. Birds singing, whatnot. And my wife said, well, do you have? I said, well, if you could just bring me a plain cheese sandwich. But, you know, they gave all the service, they have so many lackeys, if you will. And here I was dining. I said, you know, look, we're sitting here. Sitting here in this garden or whatnot, outside on that sidewalk. And you see, you can't venture in Calcutta. You get out of the hotel and they just descend upon you. If you get in a cab, they put their hands through the bag. I said, we have people there whose bellies are empty. And so somebody said, yeah, but what are you going to do? Are you going to try to do something for thousands of people? So before you know it, you say this is a fact of life. Mm-hmm. So
I think we're going to stop here.
Okay.